I love about it. You guys are the best. Anyway, good evening. So wonderful to see all of you this tonight for our next class. So let's just review very quickly. We were last found in the kitchen. Colonel Mustard in the kitchen with the, no. We were in the kitchen and we baked bread. We baked the challah and we took, oh wait, Fred has a question already? Can't be.
No.
I'll lower your hand. They're good. Okay.
Thank you. I'm trying to reset this.
I got you. All right, so we're in the kitchen. We baked the challah and we even did the mitzvah of taking off the challah. And then last time we spoke, we talked about washing the bread, washing the beautiful mitzvah of netilas yodayim, of washing our hands. So what are we up to now? We've baked it. We've made the al netilas yodayim. We've washed our hands ritually for it. Now
eating.
We're ready for
eating
it. Very good. Yay. Exactly. We're going to talk about eating the challah. But it really is going to get into a much larger conversation about eating in general. I'm probably going to end up doing this in a two-part series. We're going to do this as everything related to the eating of it. And then hopefully, God willing, next week, we'll talk about the benching afterwards. It really deserves its own class. So that being said, let me ask you all a very serious question. It's something that if you haven't thought about, you need to. Do we eat to live or do we live to eat? It's a very serious question. I see the look on Sid's face. Very serious. Do we eat to live or do we live to eat?
A little bit.
I eat to live.
You eat to live because obviously if you don't eat, you can't live. Okay, I can live with that. That's fine. What kind of foods are good for you to eat so that you can live, Fred?
Salmon.
We don't have to go that specific, but that's good.
I follow a pretty good diet. I mean, I was always told to have a main course, to have a vegetable on your plate, preferably something green.
Great, excellent. So you're answering the question, not even getting too specific. You have to have a healthy, balanced diet. Yes. That's really what it is. If you're going to eat to live, then you have to make sure that you're putting in the good stuff. Imagine if you treated your car like you treated your body. Yeah. Most of us would have engines that are in deep, you know what, deep trouble. Because instead of putting in gasoline, we put in, I don't know, canola oil or worse. We put in other stuff.
It just be fine.
You do that to the car, it won't work. You put it into your body, you put in all the junk, somehow it still works until, God forbid, we run into trouble. But the concept that you are eating to live is not a foreign concept in Judaism, not at all. Maimonides writes that the reason why we eat is the means of keeping healthy and balanced so that it enables us to do the more important business of serving God. You see, even within the realm of Fred's answer that we're eating to live, you have to answer the question, what am I living for? Right? If you're eating to live and the point of living is just to eat more, so then you're just a hamster on the wheel. You're eating so that you have the energy to eat more, so that you have the energy to eat more, so that you have the energy to eat more. That's not a life. It obviously has to be in line with, I'm eating to live, but I'm living for a reason. There's a goal. There's what I want to accomplish in my life. We've said this many times. The fact that God created a human being comprised of two parts, body and soul. They're not contradictory. They're not even separate. They're supposed to work together in harmony for a common goal, a common purpose. Yes, partake of the delicious foods, the beautiful pleasures of the world. But you have to harness it for a means, not a mean to, it's not an end unto itself. It has to be a means towards an end. Fine. So we eat to live. I'm totally fine with that. The problem is as follows. Not that long ago, just a few months ago, we were celebrating the high holidays. Obviously, we know it's Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, into Sukkot. But let's focus on Yom Kippur for a moment, since we're talking about eating. Now, we don't eat on Yom Kippur. Why? Well, because the Torah says so. You're right. I can't mark you wrong on that. But does the Torah give a reason, or at least phrase it, that we know we're not supposed to eat on Yom Kippur? Most of us will be shocked to hear that when you read the verse that tells us about fasting on Yom Kippur, what it says is, Ta'anu et nafshotechem. You shall afflict your, most of us would think, your body. That's what we're supposed to do. We don't partake of the physical pleasures. We don't smear on anointing oils. We don't take baths and showers on Yom Kippur. We certainly don't do pleasure bathing like swimming. We don't involve ourselves in physical intimacy with our spouse. We refrain from eating, because what we are doing is we're putting aside all of our physical and we're focusing on our spiritual. Doesn't that make sense? Isn't that what Yom Kippur is all about? So then it becomes problematic, because the verse that I read to you about what it is we're supposed to do on Yom Kippur, we're supposed to afflict our, I expect the word to be body, but it doesn't. It says you shall afflict et nafshotechem, your nefesh, your soul. Afflict your soul? Well, if I were interpreting the Torah, parentheses, thank God I don't, is I would understand that to mean you shall afflict your soul. I want you to gorge yourself, have no involvement whatsoever with spirituality on this holy day of Yom Kippur, because I'm afflicting my soul. I'm going to involve myself in immorality and idolatry and maybe even go up the chain to murder, you know, the good stuff. That's going to afflict my soul. But yet our sages clearly understand that totally differently. Afflicting our soul are all of the inuyim, all of the afflictions that I just mentioned, which are all putting aside the physical pleasures. So then why? Why would the Torah use the terminology, especially when you're talking about not eating or drinking, to afflict our souls? But wait, it gets worse. We know that we're not supposed to eat on Yom Kippur. However, many people don't know that we're supposed to eat, and to eat well, the day before Yom Kippur. On the 9th of Tishrei, Yom Kippur is the 10th of Tishrei, but on the 9th, we're supposed to eat and drink. The simple understanding is because we're about to fast and you want to make sure that you're hydrated, that you have the proper nutrition so that you could fast and not be in a state of mind of where you're missing the whole point of Yom Kippur. However, the Talmud says that one who eats and drinks on the 9th of Tishrei, it's as if he fasted both the 9th and the 10th. What he accomplishes by eating on the 9th is even more than what's being accomplished by fasting on the 10th. Now, I hear Bubby Prince being like, yes, that's what I'm talking about. I'm not going to kill myself to go fast on the 10th. I'm going to work doubly hard on the 9th and make sure I eat a lot. I'm good. Rabbi said it's twice as good. I am off the hook for fasting on Yom Kippur. Well, if my Zoom gets erratic and then you lose me, please understand that's not the end of the story, and don't try this at home. Okay. How does this work? How do we understand this concept? So I think it's important to understand what was the most, what was the prototype, what's the better word? What was the food that epitomized, that's the word, that epitomized spirituality within the food?
Manna.
Yes, that is correct. The manna. The manna that fell down from heaven that sustained the Jewish people when they went through the desert. Clearly, it's not something that's grown in the field. There was no field. It's a desert, for goodness sakes. So we're told that the manna fell from heaven, but yet it was a real bona fide food that was eaten. This was not something that fell from heaven and you just had to wear a patch and it was somehow absorbed into the body, you know, like one of these fabulous newfangled technology kind of thing that exists in our world. No, the manna had to be eaten. In fact, the Talmud and others discuss, what bracha did you make on it? There were five opinions that I came across so far.
Yeah.
But it was a food. It was a real bona fide food that you ate, you ingested with your mouth. Yet the Talmud tells us, for example, it was of such purity of the content between the balance between it being a spiritual item that provided sustenance to both body and soul, that it had no waste product. There was no need to go to the bathroom after partaking of the manna. I don't know what that means. I'm just taking it for what it says. But this was like, it's almost as if, I can use the terminology, there are invisible ingredients inside food. There are invisible ingredients. You know, it wasn't that long ago that people decided whether something was good to eat or not based on two things: how delicious it tasted and how good it looked. Those were the only factors. Who knew about calories? Who knew about carbohydrates? Who knew about saturated versus unsaturated fats? How many total dietary fiber grams? Who knew from any of this stuff 200 years ago? Now you can't eat a thing without looking at a label. At least I can't, right? Now everything, I'm like, no, I don't think I'm going to have it. Why? It's not that, no, it has one extra gram.
It's not time. You just have to get the...
You know, like, come on, seriously, Tachman, get with the program. But that's what it is now. But back then they didn't have this. So how did you know? So were there calories in there? Of course there were. Can you point to the calorie when you look at the donut? No, you can't. It's an invisible ingredient. Okay, we know it's more than that. But the truth of the matter is that there are spiritual ingredients in food. You don't think about it, but there are. There are real spiritual ingredients in foods we eat. I'll tell you an interesting thing. What is the staple of life? What food?
Bread.
Bread. How do you say bread in Hebrew?
Hummus?
No. Alan's got it. He mumbled it. Lechem. Lechem. Like we say, the blessing over bread. Hamotzi.
Lechem.
Lechem. Right. So lechem means bread. But interestingly enough, the same root of the word lechem is found in the word milchama. Milchama means war. The middle three letters of the word milchama is mem. The last one is hey. But in the middle is lamed ches mem, lechem. Milchama. What does bread and war have to do with each other? In Hebrew, there's no coincidences that the words are related. So Rav Hirsch writes this. It's so beautiful. He says, because the first arena of a battle between the physical and the spiritual took place in the Garden of Eden when man was tempted by food, the tree. Whatever that food was, wheat, grape, esrog, fig, it was not an apple. Don't even say it. That's not on the list. That was a much later invention that somebody was trying to translate, but it's not an apple. Okay. Be it as it may, whatever it is, the point is that the very first struggle, the very first battle, the milchama was over lechem, was over the food. Was he going to partake of it? The first sin, right? That was the first downfall of man. Of where he put his physical needs over his spiritual needs. Now, it's not a fait accompli. We're not in trouble because we were given another chance a little bit later in history. Fast forward about 2,400 years. Sharon, to be precise, 2,448 years. Right, Sharon? 2,448 years later. The Jewish people are getting ready to leave Egypt. the Exodus. Strange. We are given a mitzvah while we're still in Egypt, the day before we leave, what's known as the Karban Pesach, the Paschal offering. What's interesting is not just that we were given that mitzvah, but the rules related to that mitzvah. It was not the main course. It was not the main course. I'll prove it to you. When we sit down at our Seder nowadays, Pesach night, Seder night, and we eat, what is the food item that's on the table that is the representation or symbolic representation of that Paschal offering? Believe it or not, it is your
shank, lamb shank.
Shank bone on the Seder plate, but something you actually eat.
Matzah.
Be more specific.
Middle matzah?
Nope.
The afikoman?
Yes, Fred. The afikoman. The last thing you eat of the night. Think about that for a second. The afikoman is the representation of eating the Karban Pesach, which was the same rule. The rule was, I'll say it in Hebrew and then I'll translate, it's an obligation that it is nechal al hasova. It is eaten only upon satiation, after you've had your meal. It was your dessert. Yeah, that's for me. Sid, you and I got this. If you're telling me that I have to consume another piece of brisket or another piece of good, serious meat for dessert, sign me up. That's for me. But that is the truth. Now, why would that be? If it's meat. Now, again, afikoman is only the symbolic representation of it. In the times of the temple, they actually had a piece of meat at the end of the meal after they already had the main course. Why? Why would the law be that you have to eat it specifically after you've had your meal, after you've reached some point of fullness and satiation? The answer is because it's not about filling your belly. It's not about the physical. You need to eat something, or as Fred put it, eat to live. In this case, it's living to eat. I'll say it again. We live to eat. Ah, look over here. Look at that. The twins are here.
Yeah, Rabbi T.
Hi. That's so cute. Yeah. Right? This point is that we are actually living so that we could eat something. Not because I'm hungry. Not because my belly says it needs to be filled. But rather, through consecrated, sanctified eating, we are moving up the ladder. We are improving. Whereas Adam and Eve messed up, we, the Jewish people, when we were becoming a nation through the Exodus, we rectified that new reversion, a revised version. We formed the Jewish people through consecrated eating. And that's why it's only being eaten after you gave the body something. Now I want you to eat for another reason. You say, Rabbi, what possible reason could there be if not to fill your belly? Good, I get it. I'm supposed to make a blessing and it's a mitzvah to eat certain foods, but what are you talking about? So I need to tell you something really, really important. I started to allude to it, the fact that there are invisible ingredients. You know what ingredients are in foods? Holy sparks. And I'm not talking flint. I'm talking holy spiritual sparks. This is not the time and place, but I'll just give you a quick 1 minute crash course in a basic idea of Kabbalah. I'm not an expert and I'm still under 40. Right? So that I don't really know that much. The idea is as follows. God is represented by light. Okay. We're good with that. That's not a foreign concept for us. It's an Ein Sof. It's an limitless amount of light. God decides he's going to create a universe. He's going to create a world. Now, by definition, creating a world means it's finite. That's akin to, that's similar to trying to take a gallon of liquid and pour it into a quart-sized cup. What's going to happen? Well, most of you are going to say, well, it's just going to spill all over the place. That's true. But in Kabbalah, it uses a different analogy. Trying to cram in an entire gallon into a quart size bag or a quart size container is going to shatter the container. And therefore, those sparks of light get thrown everywhere because it makes a mess. This is the analogy. The godliness, that light, being trying to get it in an infinite light into a finite vessel is going to cause the vessel to shatter and holy sparks go all over the place, down to even the physical objects that we use, including for our topic for tonight, food. It makes sense. I'll show you why. When we talk about kosher, right, which is obviously the direction I want to go with this, kosher foods, the Torah tells us that there are certain foods that we are allowed to partake of, and there are certain foods that we are asked not to partake of. Okay, I'm being gentle. Where the Torah commands us not to eat them. It wasn't a, if you'd like to consider this, check here. No, it wasn't a multiple choice question. Okay, we are commanded to keep kosher. These foods we can eat and these foods we should not. Why? Why? What difference does it make? Because that one tastes better? No. Kosher food is what? The answer is because the foods that we are allowed to partake of contain those holy sparks. And here's the important part. They are accessible to be attained. They can be reached. Non-kosher foods, you cannot access those sparks. They are inaccessible to us. I know this sounds like a very foreign concept, but hear me out. The word kosher, where does it appear in the Torah?
I think it does.
You are correct. It does not appear even once in the entire five books of Moses. The word kosher does not exist there. It's a later term. And even when it goes down to Jewish law in halacha, when it talks about kosher and non-kosher, the words that are used are permitted and forbidden. Mutar and asur. Mutar means permissible. You are allowed to eat it. And that which is forbidden is called asur, not allowed. But I'm not doing it justice because the words mutar and asur literally mean unbound and bound. Mutar means released, unbound. Like we say every morning, one of the blessings we say as part of the brachos in the early morning that we say is Baruch Ato Hashem, blessed are you Hashem, Elokeinu Melech HaOlam, our God, King of the Universe, matir asurim, who releases those who are bound. Does that sound familiar?
Yeah.
The words matir means to untie, release. Asurim from the word bound. So the words, the terminology we use to describe that which is allowed to be eaten is known as releasing, untied, able to be reached, accessible. That which is forbidden for us to eat is because it's asur. It is bound. You cannot get to it. Therefore, there is no reason to eat it. Why are you eating it? For purely physical reasons? That's not a Jewish concept. The reason to eat food is that your body can get nourishment and, not or, it's an and, your soul will get nourishment from those holy sparks. If it's a non-kosher food, you know why you don't eat it? It's because you can't access anything for your spiritual side. So why eat it? It's just giving you only purely physical. The Torah says that's not how you grow in life. I mean, that's how you grow physically and that's how you get in trouble. But that's not why we're here. We eat so that we can live. And we live, though, because we want to eat things that will allow us to access those sparks. It's for that reason, interestingly enough, how is it this late already? I already mentioned the fact that the first sin was committed involving eating, right? We now have to recognize that that battle of primacy, for primacy is between the physical and the spiritual, is over the word lechem, bread, food. That's where it's at. And I mentioned that we rectify this through our eating, specifically on the holiday of Passover. But holiness that's involved in each one is fascinating. Let's talk about this for a minute. There, if you took all the mitzvot in the Torah, all of them, all 613, you can divide them into two categories. Some will say it's between positive and negative, and that's true. But you could also divide them into what we call mishpatim, which means law, and chukim, which are statutes, meaning there are those that we as human beings, we understand, or to some degree understand the rationale behind it. And then there are things that are chukim, that are statutes, that really I don't fully understand. It doesn't come intuitively to the human mind, but that's what God decreed, so that's what I do. So for example, keeping Shabbos. Shabbos is an intuitive concept of where we're not designed to work 24/7 all the time. We need a break. We are not designed, both physically and emotionally and in every way, we can't do this, be on all the time, 24/7. Okay, so I intuitively can understand. I can understand the mitzvah of giving tzedakah, of sharing my wealth. I can understand that. It fits very nicely. But there are certain laws that are just, it's what God asked me to do, but I can't say it's intuitive. For example, the laws of purity and impurity, right? Washing my hands before, so that's not fair. I gave you all those insights already. But things of that nature. But here's what I want to get at. Listen carefully. Can I meet my nutritional needs, let's say through an IV? Can my body get its nutritional needs through an IV? The answer is yes. Mm-hmm. The answer is absolutely yes. So then why did God create it that we have to ingest all different kinds of foods? And none of the foods look the same, taste the same, smell the same. I mean, I was in Russia many years ago and we went into a store. They only have three options. It's not like we have here in the States. I hate going down the cereal aisle. I can't stand it because there's literally 85 options. 85 cereals, for goodness sakes. Cereal. We're talking about cereal. I laugh. It's ludicrous already. 85 options.
Yeah, it is
this
true.
Brand and that brand. And yeah. This flavor of that flavor of that kind. I mean, how many Chex cereals? I'm even doing kindness here, right? There's rice Chex, there's corn Chex, there's multigrain Chex, there's cinnamon Chex. I'm like, for goodness sakes, there's a Chex. Make a Chex. That's it. Right. Okay. I'm off my soapbox. Thank you for listening. Okay. But the fact of the matter is that you can get your nutritional needs without all of these options. But yet God created oranges that have one smell and apples that have another and bananas and lemons. And there's all, why? Because we all know the difference between getting your nutrition through an IV and your nutrition by eating something is the pleasure, your enhancement of it, your taste buds. Ah, when you eat cinnamon Chex, it's like, ah. Oh. It's almost like the Garden of Eden. I'm tempted to say that's what the tree was, cinnamon Chex.
Rabbi T, that would make it the Garden of Eating.
Yes, that's correct. I went to a restaurant where that's what it was called. I went to two. One was called Delicate Essen. Essen is Yiddish for eating, so it was Delicate Essen instead of Delicata. And the other was the Garden of Eating. That's exactly what it was called. Both kosher, by the way, just in case you were wondering. Okay. But why? So the point is very simple, and that is God wants us to have an enhanced pleasure. Taste it. Enjoy the texture. There are certain people that don't eat avocado, right? That don't eat it because it's a texture thing. I'm sure it's delicious, but I can't do it. But you have this kind of fruit and that kind of vegetable, and God created the most amazing thing. But you can't appreciate it if you're getting all of that through an IV or a feeding tube. So the taste of all of these things is an enhancement. It's not discussing the core nutritional value. You can get that without the taste. Why am I telling you all this? Because it's not a coincidence. The word for taste in Hebrew is ta'am. Ta'am is taste. They say it in Yiddish also. If something is batamt. Right? Do you ever have batamti pickles?
Yeah.
But why do you think it's called batamti pickles? Because in Yiddish, they use that word, but flavorful. That's a pickle. Right? That's why it's called batamta. But ta'am is taste. But it means something else. There's another translation of the word ta'am. It means reason. In the Talmud, whenever the Talmud asks a question about what's the reason for such and such, why is it phrased? It says, my ta'ama. What's the reason? So why is it the word ta'am mean both reason and taste? Ladies and gentlemen, is because our understanding, our reasoning should be understood on the same level as taste. It doesn't change the pure nutritional value, whether I understand it or not. It is. The same way I get the full nutritional value of a food through the IV or through the feeding tube, and what the taste does is enhances my pleasure of it, my understanding and my reasoning is the same thing. Even if I don't understand something, it has nutritional value spiritually. If you were to ask me when I was younger, did I understand the reason behind many of the mitzvot? The answer is no. Did I do it? Yes, I did. Part of that, a large part of it, is because of my upbringing. My parents get credit for that. But even at a point of where I was making the decisions, can't say I really understood it. Did I fully comprehend? No. Even to this day, I have questions, and that's fine. But taste and reason go hand in hand. Even if I can't taste it, I can get nutritional value. Even if I can't understand the mitzvah, there's nutritional value. That's why it has the same meaning. Mitzvos, just as one's nutritional needs are met, even through an IV, so too the minimal goal of mitzvos is provided by the mere physical act of doing it. But it's enhanced. My appreciation for doing the mitzvah. You know why Shabbos is so good? Because we understand more about it. We understand that it provides both physical, emotional relief from a rough week. It gives me an opportunity to refocus my priorities. You know why kosher is good? It's because I can list 5 reasons. I have to think. I don't just walk anywhere and just eat anything. It means I have to think. What am I doing? I'm not a robot and I'm not an animal. I have to take a moment to think. That's a great thing. Cause me to stop and think, not put life on cruise control. It prevents certain characteristics. You know the expression, you are what you eat? It's true. And since I've been eating much healthier, my wife has been calling me all these funny names. Sometimes I give her an idea and she goes, that's bananas. Just kidding. Right? You are what you eat. Let me tell you a fascinating thing about the foods we eat. Let's start at the basics. Are there any vegetables that are not kosher? What vegetables are not kosher?
They have to be checked.
That doesn't make them not kosher.
They have to be checked.
That has nothing to do with the vegetable. That's because we have a separate prohibition in the Torah that you're not allowed to eat insects.
Right.
But if it's an insect-free vegetable, are there any vegetables that are inherently not kosher?
No, I don't think so.
That is correct. There are none, not one. But wait, watch what happens here. So vegetables, vegetative matter, right? What is its personality? What are its characteristics? The answer is nothing. They are vegetative. There is no personality. We use the terminology like somebody who behaves like you're behaving bananas, right? But it's not. It's really not. It doesn't have a life essence. Why? Because vegetables don't have an impact on mankind when you eat it. You are what you eat. So you eat vegetables. So you're in neutral. You're not good. You're not bad. But wait, when you start moving up the chain and you start getting to living creatures like animals, okay? Animals, well, they may be harmful based on what kind of animal it is. You're ingesting an animal that's a cruel and, a predator. Guess what? You are what you eat. The Torah forbids us from eating those kinds of animals. Think about what animals are considered kosher. What do you have? You have cows. What do cows do all day?
Eat grass.
Chewing grass. That's it. It could have a predator right near it. The cow is not going anywhere. It's got split hooves. What do split hooves make the animal? Slower. That's what it does. Split hooves. And what is chewing its cud all about?
Digesting the food.
It what?
Digesting their food.
Correct. And that's what they're doing all day long. They're digesting food. Okay. It's not a harmful thing. What other animals? You have deer. Deer are kosher. You can have venison as long as it's slaughtered all the other. But it is a kosher species. Buffalo, same category. What other animals?
Lamb.
Who?
Lamb.
Goat, sheep. Lamb. I mean, these are docile animals. The Torah says, go right ahead. You can eat those because they're not going to have a negative influence. Bear. Right? Dog. I know that in the Far East, in many of their cultures, dog is a part of their diet. Can't eat it. Under Torah law, no dice. Right? Any animal that has that cruel, vicious, predatory kind of characteristic, Torah says don't eat it. That's the commonality about land animals. How about birds? The majority of birds, of fowl, that we are not allowed to eat are birds of prey. Vultures, eagles. I mean, these are, they tear with their talons. They eat it on the run. That's not the characteristics the Torah wants to imbibe within us. Yes, Muriel.
Then why can't we eat pigs?
Great. So pigs have only one of those characteristics. It's a long conversation, but I'll put it very simply. You can divide all land creatures. I'm not talking about insects and rodents, and I'm not talking about fowl. I'm talking about animals. Okay? There's two categories. There's three categories, sorry. You have those that have two signs, both signs of split hooves and are ruminants, meaning they chew their cud. You have a whole bunch of those. You have even more that have neither split hooves nor chew its cud. And then you have the middle category that have one, but not both. There are only four such examples. Camel, hyrax, pig, and I forget what the fourth one is. There's only four. The Torah lists them by name. Okay?
Must be llama.
A llama? No. No, it's not a llama.
A llama chews its cud?
I don't know. I don't know, but it's not a llama. That's not one of the four. I don't know. I mean, yeah, I'm open to hear if anybody knows what the story with the llama is. Is it a completely split hoof, or is it more like the camel? The camel has some kind of split, but it's not a completely split hoof.
I think it's a ruminant. Like.
Okay, it could be. Then maybe its hooves are not completely split, like the camel. Okay? But whatever. The point being, the pig of those four, three of them are ruminants but don't have split hooves. The pig is the one exception of all of them. It has completely split hooves, but is not a ruminant. The pig is the epitome, I should say the epitome of trying to present itself as kosher and as a hypocrite. He is internally, because he sticks his hooves out, so to say, and says, look, I'm kosher. Meanwhile, internally, it's not. The other three we see very clearly. We know, right? They're not completely split hooves. So I know that. The pig prances around as if it was making itself seem that it's kosher. That's despicable. You're trying to show you're one way when you're really not. The other ones aren't sticking out their hooves. They're not completely split. The pig is the exception. That's why it's considered the worst of the worst. It has nothing to do with hygiene. It has nothing to do with what we thought hundreds of years ago, that it played in the mud and it got diseases. It may or may not be true, but that's not the reason. That is not why the Torah says no. Having both signs of completely split hooves and chews its cud means it is a docile animal that does not have a negative influence on a human character. That's the answer. Now, before we knew a lot of this stuff, was there a mitzvah of keeping kosher? 500 years ago, 1,000 years ago, was there a mitzvah of keeping kosher? Of course, it was in the Torah. Did they understand why? Probably not. Maybe not. I don't say probably, but maybe not. Our understanding of the sciences has grown tremendously. But my point is that just because you can't understand the reason doesn't detract from the fact that it provides the spiritual nutritional content. No different than the taste of an orange. It's there. The nutritional value is still there. And perhaps that's the reason why that when we talk about food, it's a diet for the soul, not just for the body. When on Yom Kippur it says you shall afflict your soul, of course it's talking about eating, because your soul has been benefiting for 364 days of the year from eating, because you ate kosher food. You made a bracha on it. You benched afterwards. Your soul has the ability to unlock those holy sparks that you now can partake. So your soul is constantly getting benefit from eating. Fred, here's where you and I will part ways. I don't eat to live. I live to eat. That's what I'm all about. I love and live to eat. That's what it's all about. It's interesting. Whenever the Torah talks about the mitzvah of keeping kosher, it always is in the context of you shall be a holy nation. Isn't that amazing? It doesn't say it just as for hygiene or health. It always has it in the context of you should be Anshei Kodesh, people of holiness, a nation of sanctity. And it goes right away into talking about what foods to eat and not to eat. In a million years, I would have never made the connection. I would have said eating is something that, you know, God created us. We have a physical body, need to nourish it, take care of it. Okay, be smart. Eat healthy foods, but it's all about your body. Wrong. The Torah says eating is all about your soul. Yes, it's for your body also. But it is primarily for your soul. Access the greatness. You become great. You can become holy if you follow these laws. Ben? Next. I can keep going here. 1 second. Divers, oh, fine. Next.
What time is it? I have a question. Can I ask before we start?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm sorry. The whole concept, I'm still trying to get the concept of the taste and reason going hand in hand. So if you don't understand the reason, that's meaning keeping following the Torah as far as the kosher laws providing the spiritual content or just food in general?
Everything in general. Everything. Food is the great example that shows us that you can get the spiritual content even though you don't have the taste, which is equal to you can get the spiritual nourishment even without the reason.
Run that by me again. I'm having a hard time with that for some reason.
It's taste equal reason. That's the formula. Taste equal reason.
Yeah, but I'm still not getting that for some reason.
You're stuck on that concept?
Yeah, I'm not understanding how tasty is it. To me, it's like, if you had an IV...
The starting point, Robin, is that it's the same word in Hebrew.
Right.
Taste and reason. Can I eat... Let's talk about physics. If I eat a food and there's no taste, can I get nutritional benefits?
Yes. Yes.
Can I do a mitzvah without understanding the reason? Will I get the nutritional...
Oh, okay. I see. Okay.
The answer is yes. I can get the full spiritual nutritional benefit of performing any mitzvah, even though I lack the reason and understanding. Same way, I can get the same nutritional physical value out of a food, even though I won't get the taste.
Okay.
That's the analogy.
Okay, I got it now. Yes, but to appreciate what you're saying, to get the spiritual part, to appreciate that's why we have the different foods, to get this
correct.
Part.
Because God wants us to spend time trying to understand. He doesn't want us just to do mitzvahs robotically because we're going to get it through an IV or we'll get it through just by performing it. We are to try to understand the same way that it taste enhances our appreciation of the physical food. So to reason enhances our pleasure of performing a mitzvah.
Okay, I get it now. I'm sorry. Somehow there wasn't that connection before, but I get it.
I wasn't so clear on it, but that's fine.
Okay.
But so watch what happens now, okay? I wasn't going to do it, but now you got me going here. The point of eating is not just the physical nutritional value for the body, but it's also for the sanctity for the soul. Watch what happens. If I'm going to sit down to a bread meal, I'm going to have challah. Okay, let's Shabbos. I'm going to have challah. So what do I do? First thing I do is I wash my hands like we talked last time. I ritually prepare myself and I make a bracha. I recognize that I'm about to do something, not just spiritual, not just physical, but it has a spiritual content. Why else am I washing my hands ritually? I'm about to do something that has spiritual content. I sit down to the table and before I eat it, I hold on to it with my fingers and I make a bracha. Hamotzi lechem min haaretz. Now I'm ready to partake of it. And when I'm done with my whole meal, I have birkat hamazon, I have benching, and I acknowledge it. So I've surrounded all of my eating at the table with mitzvos that got me focused when I started and a mitzvah at the end to keep me focused on what it was all about. And I've bookended my entire meal. But you know what? I also did something during the meal. What else did I do during the meal that keeps me focused that eating, sitting down to eat a meal wasn't just for physical? What do I do during my meal?
Blessings during any new food you eat? In other words, if the vegetable, one for the...
Besides for the...
Paying attention to what you are eating.
Okay. There's a mitzvah. I say a Dvar Torah... I share a Torah thought at my table.
Oh.
Why? Oh, because that's what rabbis do. No, it's because that's why you're enhancing your meal. Because again, it's not just about the physics. It's about the spirituality of eating. And therefore, before you eat, you're priming yourself. While you're eating, you sing a song for Shabbos. You say some thought of Torah. And when you're done, you end with a mitzvah. That's how you make all of your eating spiritual. You follow me? Watch this. Those of you know that when I don't have a bread meal, let's say I have something, let's say I have a cookie. Remember in the old days when I had cookies, remember? Right. So you don't make hamotzi on a cookie. You make a different bracha. You make a mizono, barei minei mizonot. It's one step down. It's made from grain, but it's not elevated to the status of bread. So it doesn't get hamotzi lechem in haaretz. It's a barei minei mizonos. But that also means when I finished eating those cookies, I don't bench. But there is an after bracha. There's an after bracha. Some of you might know it by name. It's called al hamichya. It's an al hamichya. It's a much shorter version of benching. It's the abridged version. And it touches on the same outline, the same format that we have in our full benching. This is the condensed version. It's almost, I hate to use the term, but it's like the Cliff Notes. If you want to just get the basic storyline of what, you guys know, remember Cliff Notes? Okay. We all used it instead of reading the book? Right. Okay. I mean, that's what my friends did. My friend, they told me about it. Okay. But what this blessing is literally parallels. It uses similar terminology for each paragraph. This goes into one bracha and it's one sentence to represent that paragraph, second sentence to represent that paragraph, and it goes through those four paragraphs. But there are two words that are added in that blessing that are not found in the actual benching. The words are bikdusha uvetara, with sanctity and purity. My eating, my partaking of it. Hold on, let me read you the verse. Let me read you what it says. Yeah. Blessed are you, Hashem, our God, King of the universe, for the nourishment and the sustenance and for the produce of the field, for the desirable good and spacious land. If you've said benching in English, these words are very familiar to you. Right? The spacious land that you were pleased to give our forefathers as a heritage to eat of its fruit and be satisfied with its goodness. Have mercy, Hashem, our God, on Israel, your people, on Jerusalem, your city, and on Zion, the resting place of your glory, upon your altar and upon your temple. Rebuild Jerusalem, the city of holiness, speedily in our days. Bring us up into it and gladden us in its rebuilding, and let us eat from its fruit and be satisfied with its goodness, and bless you upon it in holiness and purity. Those last two words, in holiness and purity, are nowhere in the benching. Yet it's found in this, what's called the three-faceted after blessing. If you want to find it in your art scrolls on page 200. What? Why do we add those words with sanctity and purity? Holiness and purity. The answer I saw just this week as I was preparing for this, beautiful, is that whereas when you have a bread meal, you've bookended, you've done things before the meal, you've done things during the meal, and you're even doing things after the meal that remind you what this is all about, of sanctity and purity and holiness, of living to eat. But when you partake of cookies, where you're not washing Netilas Yodayim first, you're not making Hamotzi Lechem in Haaretz, and there's no benching afterwards, what's going to keep you focused on the fact that you're eating for a sense of holiness? You have to add it into the prayer to remind you of it. Otherwise, why change the text? That's the answer that I saw. Beautiful concept. But let me finish with this. Finish with one more piece. There was a man by the name of the Chafetz Chaim. The Chafetz Chaim lived in a small city in Europe known as Radin. And he ultimately... He lived in the 1800s. He died, I think, in 1933. He's most famous for his work of making much more accessible the laws regarding not speaking Lashon Hara. That's one of his famous, famous books. He wrote many books on the laws of Lashon Hara. He also wrote an incredible work on explaining all of the details of the laws regarding day-to-day living. It's known as the Mishnah Brura. But why was he called the Chafetz Chaim? That's not his name. His name was Yisrael Meir Kagan. Why did he get the name Chafetz Chaim? It's because that's the name he gave to his book on not speaking Lashon Hara, not speaking gossip and negative of others. Why did he base it? Why did he give it that name? Because it's based on a verse in Psalms that says, Mi ha'ish, who is the person, who is the man, hechafetz chayim, that desires life? Mi ha'ish hechafetz chayim, who is the man that desires life? And it talks about the next sentence, Nitzar lishon chameira, guard your tongue from speaking evil. Usfasecha midaber mirma, and from your lips speaking deceit, lies and deception. And it goes on. Shomer piv ulishono, somebody who guards his mouth and his tongue, shomer mitzaros nafsho, will be protected from any harm to his soul. He named the book Chafetz Chaim because that's what this verse is all about. Guard your tongue. Be careful how you speak. I didn't know this until, again, as I was preparing once for this class, that there's a Zohar, the great book of mysticism, who also talks about this verse. But he takes it a little bit further. And the Zohar says that if you want to know the path to life, and he's not talking only in this world, he's talking about eternal life, then what we need to do is guard the two areas that are associated with the mouth. Two areas. One, what goes in, and the other is what goes out. What goes out, that's what the great Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan wrote all about. Being careful how we speak. Not speaking negatively of others. I know we've spoken about this concept before, but it probably deserves a little bit of a refresher of how careful we have to be about not speaking negatively to others, about others, whole topic unto itself. Says the Zohar, we have to be careful with the things related and associated with our mouth. One is what goes out, how we speak. But also, says the Zohar, what goes in, what we eat. If you want to guard your soul for eternal life, be careful what you put in it. It's not a coincidence. There are two pipes in your throat. Two pipes, the esophagus and the trachea. The esophagus for food, the trachea for air. Aren't those the most essential things for life? Can't live without either one. Critical, yeah. They're both connected to your mouth. You're breathing in air and you're eating of food. Your ability to speak comes out your mouth. Yeah. These are the essential parts of life. This is the mitzvah about eating. You've got the bread. You've washed your hands. Now understand that there is tremendous spirituality within eating that we should be careful about. What we eat, how we eat it, when we eat it. All of this, this entire topic falls into the category of this mitzvah related to the spirituality of eating. That is a mitzvah in the Torah. That being said, I will set myself up, God willing, that next week we will talk about after we've eaten and we get to benching. We talk about the grace after meals. That is, as I'll tell you, God willing, next week. It's one of only two blessings that are mandated in the Torah itself. It deserves our study. It deserves our conversation, but we'll talk about that hopefully, God willing, next week. Any questions on this? Yes, Fred.
Well, your initial question, eat to live, live to eat. Normally, forgetting about what you said today, but when a person would answer, I live to eat, that could be gluttonous.
Correct.
I mean, without concentrating, as where the other way around, it's basically, it's a function of life to stay alive. So that's why I always took the other way of saying it.
And, if someone said right, they have to eat,
I realized what you said was absolutely correct too.
I'm paid to be an entertainer, yeah. So I have to say things that are going to catch your attention.
Now the other quick question, because you just
I'm
said
paid
something,
to be an entertainer. to keep 15 people entertained for an hour. That's what I do.
All right, very quickly. I have a terrible time trying to, if I were to bench after breakfast, it would be lunchtime by the time I finished. But can I do, you said English. I do a lot of my prayers in the morning in English. Could I do benching in English?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely, you can say it in English. Not even a question.
I don't even know why I wouldn't think of it that way, but okay.
I just recently spoke to God and he confirmed he understands English. Yes.
Yeah, so and I guess I'm sort of naive at this, but the benching part.
Well, we're not up to benching. I didn't talk about
it. No, I understand, but I need to know this. I can't wait a week, okay? It's one simple question. I thought it was just because of Shabbos, but you're saying any time we eat bread, we have to bench?
Yeah. Yep.
Everybody's shaking their heads. That means it's not even a dinner, like he's saying. It could be a breakfast, a lunch. Okay, well, I always do the brachas, but I didn't know you had to bench after, and it's just bread. Is that what you're saying? Any kind of bread?
Bread, matzah, bagel, pita,
sandwich.
Wow, I had no idea. For some reason, I thought it was related just to the Shabbos itself.
It even has to do with the washing of the hands the same way, right? Ritually washing of the hands. If you're not having challah or bread, you don't need to do that either. Correct. But so even if you had a full meal, like a dinner with chicken and all vegetables, but if no bread was served, then no benching is required.
Nope.
Okay, I did not know.
That's been one of the changes in my diet. I rarely wash for bread now. I really rarely have bread, and I can sit down to a very, very delicious, filling meal. And at the end, I say one little short after bracha. That's the whole thing. And my wife is like, you get away with murder.
Okay, I understand that now. I'm sorry I was naive about that. Why are you sorry?
Yeah. Rob, if you don't ask, you'll never know.
I know.
Keep asking. Absolutely.
But you still have bread on, you still have challah on Shabbos.
I do.
Yeah, sure.
I do. I'm not as good as you think I am.
No. I think you're good.
Isn't there even the amount of bread you have based on, I mean, you have to have a certain amount before it even qualifies? Or not?
To make a motzi or for benching?
For benching.
Yeah, you have to, what's known as a kazayas, an olive size. It's not that much.
Right.
It's not the little tiny olives that we have. In the Talmud and the Torah, olives were larger size. But it's not, if you have half a slice of normal bread, a regular loaf of bread, that's definitely enough.
Okay.
Especially if it's what do you call it? A thick bread. it's based on volume. That's really what it's based on. I know some people, it's for another conversation, you know, when we have matzah on Pesach, so it's the same requirement. You have to eat a minimal amount. Mm-hmm. So because matzah is so thin and flat, you have to eat more of it. It's not, you know, you can't just take like you would a piece of rye bread or half a rye bread. Half a rye bread's volume is significantly larger than half a piece of, you know, so you have to have a lot more matzah. So I know people that actually what they do is they do it by volume. They weigh it. They figure out the number of grams that are needed that equals a kazayas worth. And that's what they do. They weigh every matzah. I don't have time for that, but for me, I'd rather just take two extra bites and know that I'm good. But that's what it's based on, a kazayas. Now, I will say, Fred, that in terms of making hamotzi, and washing and making hamotzi on bread, that's even one bite. Even if you know that you're only having one bite's worth of bread, you still have to make hamotzi on it.
And wash the hands also.
Correct.
And wash your, okay. Good. Thank you.
The law regarding the pre-bracha and the post-bracha are not the same.
I just had remembered once about bread required when you... the washing of the hands required if you're going to have bread with your meal. Correct. That's one thing I remember hearing about years ago.
Yes,
but
that clarifies it for me too. Thanks.
The ritual washing. I recommend that you use soap and water before every meal. But the ritual washing is only required when you have anything that qualifies as a bread.
Rabbi, I know that there's the reasons we do all of these are ritually observant, but man
people didn't know about washing their hands in biblical times years ago. Isn't it possible? I mean, they didn't know about germs.
Why do you say that?
Well, because I don't think doctors 100 and some years ago were not washing their hands. My question is this. Isn't the possibility also that the fact that we as a Jewish people always, well, not if we didn't have bread, but always, even if it was ritually, washed our hands prior to eating bread, which was probably served with many meals, most meals. Didn't that also keep us a little more healthier than a group of people that would never wash their hands?
I think it's a legitimate theory. I'm not convinced that that's true. I don't know enough in terms of the science. They say that because we are very hygienic people in terms of washing our hands, because we have a million times that we have to, when we get up in the morning every day, we wash our hands. Okay. You know, I would venture to say billions of people get up every morning and they don't wash their hands. Okay. Does that make us I'll say it this way. Does that make us less susceptible to diseases and pandemic? Probably, but I can't say for sure. I'm not a scientist and I don't even want to go down that road because that's not the reason for it.
I understand that,
it very well could be. Sharon.
Hey, based on what Fred's saying, first of all, it's like when we're washing our hands spiritually, we're just pouring water over it, whether it's six times, three times, whatever it is, opposed to physically using soap and water and cleansing our hands. There's a difference between spiritually washing and actually cleansing your hands with soap and water for hygienic purposes. So it's a whole different concept.
Okay. Fair point.
I'm not arguing. Yeah, but the fact that you're even applying water to your hands has some.
Right. It also is a sensitivity. I think you can add to Fred's point, and that is we're always cognizant about the cleanliness of our hands. You can't, by the way, Sharon, just to add to this, you can't ritually wash your hands for bread unless your hands are first clean, physically.
Right.
If I have dirt on my hands, I can't wash Netilat Yodayim.
Right.
So by definition, I have to keep my hands clean. That plays into Fred's theory. I've heard this before. It's possible. It's certainly a possibility, but you know what? I decided to go the rabbinic instead of the medical route. Sorry, I'll pass on that.
I agree 100%, but it's like a side benefit. I took a trip with a bunch of singles years ago, to Jamaica. They all had a big luau or something. Everybody there ate pork except me. Guess who was the only one that didn't get sick? And someone said, well, maybe there's a thing to keep it kosher, Fred. You know, again, it's a side thing. It's not the main reason.
It could be. Any other questions?
Rabbi, you said that vegetables, they're kind of neutral. They're all kosher. And I'm wondering what you were talking about, the benefits that you get from what you eat.
Not the benefits. There's a characteristic. An animal has a characteristic. It has a personality. Right? We don't walk up behind somebody if we want to scare them and we go, meow. It's not exactly the most frightening thing, right? We growl like a bear or we bark like a dog. I mean, there's certain personalities. Vegetables don't have personalities. Yes, there are definite benefits and we use them as symbolic and we talk about you're a squirt, you're a grapefruit. I don't know. We come up with things, but it doesn't have a personality because it doesn't have a life essence. It's alive. It's a growing thing. Remember, there's four categories of everything in our world: inanimate objects, things that grow, things that are alive, and human beings. Those are your four categories.
So,
difference
so
between
has,
a stone
so
and a
Sid
flower.
Has more personality.
What?
So Sid has more personality because he eats brisket and I eat vegetables.
I was going to say, what about vegetarians? You know,
I was
next week. Maybe it's late.
Say, Sharon, listen. Obviously, I'm looking at it the other way around. if the fact that every single vegetable is can be eaten, it's kosher, means it is so much easier to access the spiritual sparks. There's no process. What do I have to do to make a carrot kosher? Nothing. What do I have to do to make an animal kosher? It's a long process. It's an ordeal. So I look at it a little differently. The ones who eat vegetables, they have it so easily accessible. Eat your vegetable, make your bracha before you eat it, make a bracha, you're done. You got all these spiritual sparks you can get. Great.
And the doesn't matter whether you're eating a vegetable or you're eating kosher meat. You're still getting those physical sparks that
spiritual sparks.
Spiritual sparks that can uplift you. Correct. And there's not more in vegetarian or more in meat.
I'm pleading the fifth on that one right now. It's not a simple yes or no. There is definitely what to discuss about it. There's
sorry.
No, that's a shame. My Zoom call is going to end in a minute. Okay. No, I'm just kidding. Food for thought, pun intended. Okay. Prior to Noah and the flood, there's no indication whatsoever about eating animals. The Torah goes out of its way to tell us after the flood that God gave permission to now partake of animals. The commentators don't miss a beat on this. And they're like, well, was this only a consolation prize? But really, it wasn't meant to be that way. It really should have only been natural stuff like fruits and vegetables. Or was that man first had to prove himself as being the top of the line? And the fact that Noah saved the animals showed he had domination over it. That gave him now license to go do it and partake of it. That's where the commentaries have conversations. You can see both arguments. They're both valid arguments. So I'm not ready to say one over the other. I there's way too much involved in that. All I can say is that when a person follows the law regarding how to make something kosher, remember, there's two aspects. The species has to be kosher. If I shech the bobcat and I do it ritually exactly the way it's supposed to be, I still can't eat a bobcat. It's not a kosher species. So it has to be a kosher species and it has to be prepared according to the kosher laws. So then if I do that, then I am able to access the spiritual sparks that are within it, as well as when I partake of vegetables or fruits, as long as, now mind you, interesting enough, this also goes back to Sharon's point. Even with fruits and vegetables, there are times I'm not allowed to eat it. Remember, the first mitzvah we talked about was Arla, the first 3 years of the fruit tree. Whoa, it's a kosher species, Rabbi. Oranges are kosher. Not the first 3 years. You can't eat it. Similarly, vegetables. What if I dedicated and I set aside 10% of my field like I'm supposed to, the produce? Those carrots I can't eat. They go to a Kohen. They go to a Levi. I'm not allowed to eat them. So there are restrictions within fruits and vegetables also, but not because the species itself is inherently not kosher or needs a preparation as opposed to an animal. You follow that, Michelle?
Mm-hmm. Okay. So before the flood, you could eat any animal.
No, no,
no.
Only we were vegetarians before the flood, weren't we?
Only after the flood. Prior to the flood, because you make it, it's implied very clearly. The Torah tells Noah, Hashem tells Noah, you now can partake. Clearly making it abundantly clear that prior to that, they did not have permission to eat animals.
I thought we were vegetarians before Noah, or before the flood, right?
Animals were used for sacrifices, for offerings, but not eaten. Mm. That's another.
But I thought they partake of the sacrifice.
What?
I thought they partake of the sacrifice.
That's our post-flood involvement with the sacrifices. It's very likely there is something called a carbon ola, an ola offering, which is completely burnt on the altar and nobody eats from it. It could be that was the default of all offerings were by definition an ola offering and the owners didn't partake of it. That's possible.
But prior to the flood, they knew what kosher animals were because he brought more kosher animals than he did other
species. That's correct. Noah, when he was given the commandment to get the animals on the ark, he only took one male and one female of the non-kosher species, and he took seven male and seven female kosher species because he was going to use some as an offering when he got off.
Mm.
Put that in your pipe and smoke it, Fred. Huh? Didn't know that, huh?
I didn't know it was that number. I thought it was...
Seven and seven. Yeah, there were 14 kosher and two non-kosher. All right, mm-hmm. That's enough.
Thanks, Joe.
Too much Torah is dangerous.
And I have to go eat dinner.
Don't forget to make a bracha.
I won't.
All right. Have a great rest of the week, everybody.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Bye. Thank you. Bye, everybody.